says the House language is on the left. It's actually the Senate language on the left and the House language on the right. So beginning in R1, then House Section 1, Senate Section 1, basically, let me say what the Senate does, and I'll try to say what I can say. Basically, the Senate requires that when a court commits a person under the civil commitment laws being mentally ill, developmentally disabled, mentally ill and dangerous, or chemically dependent, or determines a criminal case that a person is incompetent to stand trial or not guilty by reason of mental illness, or restores a person's ability to possess a firearm under either current law, which is 609.165 sub 1b, or the new section 3 in the Senate, which is 624.713 sub 4, and the House has a similar provision, that the court would have to ensure that this information be transmitted to the NICS system. Now, the House provision is pretty similar. I think the main, perhaps substantive difference is the House has the word, the court must promptly transmit information. The Senate doesn't have the word promptly. The House also has a reference in 1.14 to 1.15 to the federal law. I don't think that's substantive. It says in accordance with public law number, blah, blah, blah. The House also, on 116.117, talks about it being as a result of a judicial determination that the person's mentally ill, et cetera. That's something that the House has changed throughout and the Senate has not. So that's a difference we'll encounter again later. And then the House also has, right, view as kind of a technical difference on line 1.21, it talks about a person's firearms disability, where the Senate talks specifically about ability to possess, etc. And you'll see that again a few times later. So that's the main differences there. House Section 2 is a House only provision. It amends the current law whereby a person is authorized to bring a motion before a court to get their right essentially to possess, etc., a firearm back if they've been convicted of or adjudicate delinquent for a crime of violence. What the House does here is, and I talked to one of the advocates, and I'm not sure if the House exactly intended this, but it seems that it allows a person to get their rights back for a federal disability as well. And also what it does is it strikes a limitation that it relates only to crimes of violence. So a person could bring this motion, so to speak, for a disability based on any kind of crime or offense, which is an expansion of the current law. Bottom of R1, going through the next few pages, basically what the Senate does here is these are mostly kind of cross-referencing changes whereby the Senate refers to this new section 3 where a person can bring a motion in court to get their firearms rights back if they've been determined to be dangerous, chemically dependent, or habitual user of drugs. What the Senate does, besides the cross-references, it strikes current language that you have to possess a certificate from a doctor as to any one of those things. And then later on page R4, the Senate strikes language saying that a person who possesses or who issues a certificate would be, in good faith, would be immune from damages resulting from the actions of the person who is the subject of it. Because the Senate's basically saying that this new court action that we're authorizing will be the way that a person will get their rights back in these circumstances. The House is pretty similar, I would say. Again, some of the things we talked about earlier, they talk about a firearms disability as opposed to the specific being able to possess, et cetera. The House here also talks about, you could look on lines 2.27, 2.28, and then 3.13 to 3.14. This is where the House, under current law, if a person has basically been confined as being mentally ill and dangerous and mentally ill, or who have been hospitalized under certain circumstances for habitual use of drugs, the House seems to increase the standard a little bit or to give a little more clarity here. Instead of using the words like confined, it would use the words committed based on the judicial determination. So those are changes the House is in. They make it in these three circumstances, and the Senate does not make that change. The House also, under current law lumps people together who are ineligible to possess firearms based on non-felony drug convictions and people who have been hospitalized or committed for habitual use of controlled substances. And in both cases under current law, you have to get a certificate from the doctor in order to get your rights back. The House kind of divides that. And if you've got the non-felony conviction, then if you look on beginning on lines 3.7, there would be a 3-year period that you'd have to wait until you can get your firearms rights back. And then the people who are hospitalized, in this case the House changes it to committed, would have to bring the motion that we'll talk about in a few minutes.
What line is that?
Yeah, 3.7.
That's like 3.7 to 3.12 on the House side, the right side.
The right side's the Senate line.
No, the right side is the House side.
You just missed. I was getting confused there, sorry.
That's mislabeled on.
Got it.
On the federal side.
Thank you.
And what the House also does in this section is on page R4, the top right, the House adds language that my understanding is it attempts to mimic the current federal prohibitions on people who can't possess firearms. The state law won't be picked this up in quite the same way. And what the House would say is that a person who's subject to a court order that was issued after a hearing in which a person received actual notice and in which the person had an opportunity to participate, that restrains a person from harassing, stalking, or threatening an intimate partner and things like that, and where there's a finding that the person represents a credible threat to the physical safety of the intimate partner, then in those cases, that person wouldn't be able to possess a firearm. And another person who wouldn't be able to possess would be a person who has been convicted in any court of a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence, and that's on lines 4.26. Again, my understanding is that this is current federal law, but it's not picked up in state law. And then finally in that section, the bottom of page R4, the House provides a definition essentially of what a judicial determination would be. And we talked about that earlier. Going to page R5, Senate section 3 and House section 4, these are the provisions that authorize a person who's been committed essentially as being mentally ill, developmentally disabled, mentally ill and dangerous, or chemically dependent to petition the court to restore their rights. Again, the Senate calls it the right to possess a firearm. The House would say, you know, relief of firearms disabilities. The Senate has kind of a three-tier system. The court is able to grant relief sought if the person shows that the person is no longer suffers from the condition that led to the confinement or commitment, that the person is not likely to act in a manner that is dangerous to the public, and that the granting of the relief sought is not contrary to the public interest. The House has just those last two provisions. If you look on line 5.25 to 5.26, that's where it shows up there on the House side. If you look at 5.27, the House paragraph C, it provides that to meet the requirements of that dangerous to public safety test, the petitioner must present evidence from a licensed medical doctor or clinical psychologist that the person is no longer suffering from the disease or condition for which caused the disability, or that the disease or condition has been successfully treated for a period of 3 consecutive years, and the Senate doesn't have that. The House also clarifies that the initial hearing is de novo. Both the House and Senate say that the subsequent appeal would be de novo, but the Senate doesn't have the first part. Those are the main things there. And then the next two sections are House-only provisions, sections 5 and 6. I'll refer to the theory, but I believe those are pretty much just kind of conforming changes. I don't think anything too controversial there. And then on page R6, the House has a delayed effective date, which is July 1, 2010.
I wonder, Mr. Chair, if you could do this. I see several of the meaty areas of disagreement, but I wondered if you could take testimony on from individuals, including Ms. Martins and Professor Olson. But prior to that, maybe we could go through some sections that might be relative to that, including the sections, House sections 6 and 7 on the investigation and the insertion of the language of the National Instant Criminal Background Check System, as well as the delayed effective date, but we may want to hear from the BCA on that and their reasons for it.
The effective date, my conversation is that's the date they want, so that's one that's easy to retain. Right.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Mr. Chair. Before we get there, can I just ask a bigger or broader question, which is that these bills feel so different from one another, and are they two bills that were introduced separately and we're just marrying them together, or are they actually started as the same bill and have subsequently been changed?
The Senate file started as the same bill that I believe the House passed. I had an amendment on it in your committee, and under general orders, I believe I have a small amendment. So, and then I guess I'll let you know the last
What I can tell you, Senator Moore, is originally Ms. Martins brought in the language to me. It was largely similar to the bill that Senator Kielash had. I then began conversations with Professor Olson on his some suggestions that he had, many of, well, most of which did not make it into this version. I included what I thought were relatively innocuous provisions, but there were several that I thought required additional testimony. But I thought they were credible and innocuous differences. That said, I thought it was important to have a conference committee to discuss what those differences actually were. One was the inability of misdemeanor, gross misdemeanor pot smokers to ever get their eligibility back, which Professor Olson had suggested there should be some additional language with respect to that. Also, the inability of anyone to get their to undo their prohibition if they had, for example, a fifth degree assault, as opposed to domestic assault, which provided for an opportunity at some point to apply. And it seemed to me to be an oversight, so either it should be included or we should discuss it. Finally, the third area was the addition of the two 8 and 9 federal factors, which were included on at the end. Minnesota has 7 factors where a person, when they're convicted during the commission of the assault, they're prohibited under 7 factors in Minnesota and 9 factors federally. I thought it was important to include the additional 2. Other than that, and the successful treatment of a period of 3 years, I think the bills are relatively similar. And I'll say this because, for example, in Section 1 of both the House and Senate, the House does include the language promptly, which I believe Professor Olson said, as soon as is practicable, would be appropriate, similar federal language. But also the language including, as a result of a judicial determination, mirrors the language on the Senate side of 1.12 when a court. It's by a court action. So I actually don't think it's that much different. It's just a little bit, slightly different word.
Mr. Chairman, in support of that statement, Representative Lesson and members, may I just add the observation that a number of the House changes that are appear to be visible changes are simply conforming language where we conform to federal terminology, for example, like firearms disability instead of firearms prohibited person under current law. And as Representative Lesch already pointed out, there's quite a bit of language beginning on R4, line 15 of page 4, which is verbatim out of federal law. We were just tracking 2 earlier amendments. They were actually Senator Wellstone amendments that were adopted in the federal law in the mid-1990s, dealing with the intimate partner restraining order and misdemeanor conviction for domestic violence. These disabilities have never been tracked in Minnesota law. It's probably a good reason to do so. All of that section of Minnesota law, all of that clause of Minnesota law, starting on page 4.1, have been in Minnesota law for years. But those two federal disabilities were never picked up, and here they've been picked up. It looks like a lot of language, but throughout, a lot of it's just conforming language.
Mr. Chair, and Mr. Clear, I appreciate your explanation about some of these new terms and concepts being conforming to federal law. Was there a reverse check to make sure that as we're conforming to federal laws that we're also not moving away from certain terminologies or concepts that are kind of innate in Minnesota law throughout so that we're not creating ambiguities in certain some terms as we're conforming to federal law?
Ms. Chairman and Senator Miles, my sense, having worked in this area for some time, is that I'm very comfortable with the federal terminology and that terminology is used throughout the nation much more. So it seems comfortable to conform to federal terminology. I think that a state court looking at that terminology would have no trouble determining what it means. If a state court does not find a definition, it probably should be a definition at some point put in state law, for example, into a partner copying the federal law. But if a state court does not find that definition, it looks around, it looks at rules, it looks at federal rules, and of course federal law, and I think that would work quite well. But at some point, it probably should be a definition placed in the state law.
Mr. Chair, if I may,
yes.
Moving back toward suggesting that we do move forward, at least going to pick up some of the non-controversial language, including policy sections 6 and 7 and 8 and the effective date. I would move that language on the third small section. I'm sorry, I guess it was section 5 and section 7 and section 8. By way of explanation, it is the inclusion of the National Instant Criminal Background Check System language and the effective date. Although perhaps we should just clarify from the DCA that is in fact their desire, Mr. Chair, of that being the effective date.
Mr. Chair, Katie Engler from the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Yes, the effective date that is in the House version of the bill is the effective date that the Bureau has requested.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lesh, I've talked with Mr. Jarrett about this. The section that needs to be delayed until July 1st is only Section 1 of the bill. Section 2 of the bill, for example, which creates new crimes of violating a protective order and new crimes with regard to, or new disqualifications for violating a protective order and new disqualifications for misdemeanor crimes and domestic violence, should be effective immediately, or August 1st.
Just to clarify, you're talking about the NICS bill, right? The federal NICS bill that you're for.
Yes, sir. The federal NICS bill, which requires essentially the reporting that is in Section 1 of both bills, is required to be effective July 1st of 2010. But the access to courts for people who have mental health problems and the access to courts for people who have crimes on their record don't need to be delayed. That can be done immediately. And the same thing is true with the protective order and domestic violence prohibitions that are in Subdivision 2. Those should be done immediately. In fact, those should be done when we normally do crimes, which is August 1st. So I would suggest that the effective date for Section 2 be August 1st, 2009. The effective dates for Sections 3 and 4, or Sections 2 and 4, I guess, should be or could be immediately after the effective date. So people have access to courts right away. There's no reason to delay access to the courts until 2010, and there's no reason to delay the new prohibition on two classes of bad folks possessing firearms beyond August 1st.
Right, Professor Olson, the effective date that I moved just states that sections on,
Mr. Olson, the BECA had questions about being able to deliver some of this on time. I'm not sure that if that also includes all the court hearings, et cetera, et cetera. Is there an issue with that?
Mr. Chair, Katie Engler from the BCA again. We really can't speak on behalf of the courts. The Professor Olson is correct that the piece that the BCA is concerned about is the Section 1 transmittal of the data, because it will be moving from the courts through the BCA to the NICS system. So what you do with the rest of the provisions as far as an effective date?
The rest of the provisions are still required in order to meet federal guidelines or statutes for the
The piece that's really required to meet the grant requirement that the federal government has imposed is the petition process that is in Section 3 on the Senate side and in Section 4 on the House side.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, you're saying that also could be delayed, or Section 3 in the Senate and Section 4 in the House, what is the appropriate effective date for that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesch, really that's about court availability of a court process, and I don't have any authority to speak on behalf of them. So,
anyone else wishes to address that?
Senator, Mr. Chair, I would move an amendment to my motion then, saying on line 7.1 of 306, strike 27R and insert this, and then add after the period sections 2-7 are effective immediately upon enactment.
Well, we are amending that date onto the Senate file at this point, correct? That's the file we're looking
at? Yes, that's correct.
So let's add that section to sections at this point, the way they've done in the House. You've got section 2-7, and you have those 6, right? Three. So there's some extra sections, and that we haven't agreed upon at this point, I guess. So, the language on section 5, 6, and 7.
Mr. Chair, I would amend my motion to sections 5, 6, and 7.
Be added after. Yeah, we'll just move to accept those. Yeah, I guess then the advisors will work on that.
Mr. Chair, if I could just ask a more broad question instead of getting all the different verbiage and the meanings and this and that. I would just want to know what the substantive deal is. I mean, we brought up the word argument or whatever, but I'm wondering if we're more alike than not, and maybe there isn't so much that we disagree on. What in the totality of the whole thing on both sides, is there any really substantive difference once you figure in all the extra verbiage that we put in?
The section two on the House side is definitely a stretch from where we were. That was not discussed in any judiciary committee or any committee at all. And I guess normally we don't, if they haven't been discussed in the committee in the Senate, we don't like to add because it should be heard. In a committee that's assigned for that particular part, which in this case would be Senator Moss Judiciary Committee in the Senate. So those were not heard at any, and my understanding is this was amended on the floor, so I don't know if it got hearings in the House committee. Nope. I'm not sure what all that does. So besides that, if it changes, because it's in a different section that we've been working on.
Maybe we could do this then. It was my intention to just try to include the non-controversial ones and then get into the
We can go that way. So we've got those last three sections done.
Okay, you have to take a vote on.
I'm sorry, yeah, thank you for the reminder. All those in favor of including the House sections 5, 6, and 7 in the Senate version? Signify by saying
aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Next, we've got that part of the plan. And then there's another section where we have on.
Mr. Chair. Section one of the two bills don't seem to be that different from one another. The House side, the House language, these are switched on, so the House language has the reference to transmitting the information at the top, and we have it on the bottom. They have a reference to public law, and they have the word promptly. I would ask Mr. Backus, you know, in terms of when we do this, is it customary for us to refer to public law? Or I guess because is it customary to make a direct reference to the federal program, or can we go without the direct reference? What is the practice?
Mrs. Chair and members, in my experience with the criminal stuff, which is going to be different from other areas like government services, we don't make those type of references, and I don't think it's necessary to make it, which is I think like a Senate President habit, but it's nice to do it harm if you wanted to have it.
Could I ask, Mr. Chair, if we could, I inserted that language at the behest of Professor Olson, and maybe we could hear from him.
Mr. Olson,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lesh, what we're doing in this provision is complying with a federal mandate. And it seems to me that the cross-reference to the public law serves this purpose. If, as, and when the federal government fully decides how it wants to implement this mandate, which will take more than the letter they sent out in November, they'll be giving additional instructions to Minnesota agencies. And it seems to me that this cross-reference essentially gives our agencies authorization to make whatever procedural changes are necessary to comply with the changing federal instructions as they come out. And so it's intended to be an authorization to the agency to comply with public law 110-180, you know, however the feds tell you to do it, which is what we have to do. We don't have any real choice here. You could take it out. The reason that I put it in was, the reason I just said, was to make sure that the agency didn't feel it didn't have authority. I put in, I used promptly because as soon as practicable is three words and promptly is one.
Different things.
Well, Mr. Chair, we're the legislature, and We could choose not to comply, but in this case, we're creating Minnesota law to comply with something that could be a changing landscape. And so I asked the question about whether or not we do that. Typically, you know, we don't make those kind of cross references to federal law because that changes all the time, whereas we have control over Minnesota law. So I would like to move the Senate language in section one, inserting in line 1.19, the court shall meet promptly as soon as practicable, whatever the committee wants to decide on. I mean, I'm not married to either idea, but we should adopt the, Mr. Chair, whatever the two of you decide, if you want, as soon as practicable.
Senator Monica, the mix, was it the letter from the Attorney General, or was it in the bill itself, uses as soon as practical?
So insert at line 1.19, as soon as practicable. Is that where, after the word shall?
What that does is it sidesteps a conversation we have not yet had, which includes language regarding firearms disability on the House side. 1.21, we haven't discussed that yet. We also have not discussed.
That's fine. I withdraw my motion. I forgot that the firearms disability was in there.
Should we have that discussion right now?
Maybe we could. I could remove in the House language, just as in order to get started the conversation, Mr. Chair, strike the language at 1.14 in accordance with public, and line 1.15, strike law number 110-180.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, that motion does not commit you to either the House side or the Senate side. We can amend the House side without adopting it.
We don't, Mr. Chair, we don't have to do that. If we decide to take the House language because we want the firearms disability, we can do that without that language. I'm not trying to be hostile, I'm just trying to get us moving.
Yeah.
So why don't we just move down to have the discussion about the firearms disability and see where we land.
That seems reasonable. Are we going to get to the whole section?
Maybe if I could suggest, Mr. Chair, ask, it was, again, at the behest of Professor Olson, my understanding was that linking to a common term found in federal law to use the words firearm disability, but we could hear directly from the person's mouth on that.
Before we do that, is firearm disability used much in Minnesota law? And that's, I have trouble finding it anywhere in Minnesota law, which is part of my issue with it.
Mr. Chair, I don't believe we generally use firearms disabilities in such a lot. Usually we're more specific as the
Mr. Olson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Lesh. Part of the problem in Minnesota law is that we sometimes say ineligible, we sometimes say not entitled, we sometimes say prohibited. We have a whole bunch of different language that is used. I had prepared earlier a definition of firearms disability, which maybe I'll state it for you, and then we can talk. Essentially, we would add to section 624.712 a definition that says firearms disability. The term firearms disability means a person's prohibition by any federal or state law, however stated, from lawfully possessing, shipping, or transporting or receiving a firearm. So we can only obviously move or determine the state portion of any of these issues, but we have combined laws that don't fit together very well, and we don't have a good way of talking about it. So I was trying to come up with a term that would allow us to talk about it without using all that, repeating all that terminology over and over again. It's possible to do that, and obviously you can see in section two of the bill that when it was originally drafted, it used possess, receive, ship, transport, or otherwise deal with, trying to touch all the bases. I don't think anybody is wedded to firearms disability. It was an attempt to come up with a consistent term, at least in this bill, that would deal with that would allow us to talk to each other and know what we were talking about without a mouthful of terminology.
Minnesota, that way,
the feds, and I've got in both in the United States Code and in the very provision that we're trying to comply with, the Relief of Disabilities Program in the NICS Improvement Act, the feds consistently use the term disability. And firearms disability is what, I mean, I guess the reason it leaped into my mind is that's the term, that's the term that, that's the term that is used in both the NICS statute and the Gun Control Act of 1968 is disabilities. And when you say firearms disabilities, particularly with the definition that we have, you make it clear that you're referring to all of them to the extent that the Minnesota courts have power to act. So that was simply an attempt at providing a definition that would allow us to talk about things more easily. And I don't know whether you will want to adopt the definition or not. I realized that in talking with Senator Kalish that it made sense to have a definition.
Mr. Chair, let's just pick one and go for it. I mean, I think we're spending too much time on it.
The title of the section 624.71, which reads ineligible persons, or those persons ineligible, the definition of not being able to carry a pistol, semi-automatic, or firearm, so separate.
There are other provisions, Mr. Chairman, for example, subdivision 1B, which talks about persons receiving, shipping, transporting, and otherwise dealing in firearms. It's not in this bill because it's not being amended, but all those terms appear. One way of dealing with it, I'm not wedded to firearms disability at all. I mean, one way of dealing with it, perhaps the best way, is to take in the House version, on lines 2.2 and 2.3, restore the original language and take out, completely remove the disability. And then we can go and talk about ineligibility instead of disability if you prefer that. This shouldn't keep us here for any time at all.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My only question is, the word disability is stated is not in law, or is it covered in law, or should it been vetted someplace? I mean, are we going to be changing a lot of things?
What I've seen is that it's in the law and it's used in a variety of places. I'm not. My issue with it is, to me, it's not as clear as saying ineligible to possess or firearm. I'm a simple guy. I like to keep the language as simple as possible so everybody understands it when they look at it. Fire disability threw me until I started digging more into it, which made the letters a little better. But,
Mr. Chair, follow up. So this was not brought at all into the Judiciary Committee?
The Senate bill was gone through it. The language firearm disability was not vetted in the Senate. It was, as was Section 2, was not vetted in the Senate. So, Senator Mo, I don't know if you have anything to say on that.
I think that the bills are not, first of all, I mean, I think the bills are not that far apart in terms of what we're trying to do here. I do have some concerns with the definitional issues because I think that long term, I mean, I don't think that if we don't move towards the idea of creating a firearms disability, that we're going to be necessarily be made. eligible for this grant. I think in concept, it's really the reporting. It's the reporting, I believe, that triggers our eligibility. So I would just encourage all of us to think about whether or not we want to put into Minnesota law the idea of a firearms disability. When it's customary from Minnesota law's perspective to talk about things in terms of eligibility and ineligibility with the criteria. And then to put this into definition adds another layer in the interpretation. We might create some concerns with people wondering if we're broadening things or not broadening things. And those of us around this table, we just want to come back with our simple bill with our concept intact. I don't think we want to alarm anybody in any direction. So, you know, I would, Senator Ingebrigtsen and Lieutenant Cornish, I would look to the two of you to weigh in on whether or not.
The language that we have is a person's ability to possess a firearm, and it's either to possess it or not possess it. It seems to be as clear as I can hear.
Thank you.